So I serve as the principal at Vaux Seminary, where some of you have studied, some of you are still studying. Lectures start again this week, so if you're into praying, it would be great if you pray for us and pray for the start of the new year. We've got an excellent enrollment of new students, and we're in the business of trying to train up servant leaders for the church. Right, not today. I'm wanting us just to look at a portrait of Jesus. And I guess where I'm coming from is that I don't know about you, but I sometimes worry that we have this pretty plastic view of Jesus. And you see it in so many of the portraits that go around about Jesus. They're just not true, are they? Some particularly from the last century. If you looked at a picture of Jesus, it would be of this very pale-faced Jesus. And you'd think, wasn't he a Middle Eastern Jew? You know, what Middle Eastern Jews look as white and as pale as that? They simply don't. And then he has this lovely long locks of hair, as though he's been in some shampoo advertisement or something like that. And you think, well, I wonder, you know, is that really probable? And the answer is probably not. And those gorgeous teeth, as though he's been flossing since he was kind of a three-year-old. And you say, you know, is this the real Jesus? And yet, as you read the Gospels, they just pulsate with life. And there's this portrait of such a real Jesus. He can be exhausted. He can actually be quite irritable at times, the irritable Jesus. Sometimes he's hungry, and sometimes he's angry. And it's the angry Jesus that I'm wanting us to look at today. And there are four portraits, and they all come from Mark's Gospel. They're not the only ones I could have chosen, but because they're all condensed together in one Gospel, it makes it fairly convenient. And I thought it might be quite helpful just to say, okay, let's look at this angry Jesus. And of course, you know, when we speak about anger, we tend to think, well, that's not a very good thing, is it? Because anger can lead to ulcers. Leads to high blood pressure. It's very uncomfortable if you're in the orbit of someone who's angry. You don't usually think, oh, that was wonderful. I just loved his anger and benefited so much from it. So you have to say, you know, well, what's this anger about? And what does this say to us about Jesus? And does it change our portrait of him in any way? And does it perhaps even teach us how we maybe should be angry people at times? So, if you've got a Bible, just follow with me, and if not, I'll read the passages out anyway. But portrait number one of angry Jesus from Mark's Gospel, Mark chapter 3, verses 1 to 6. It's a healing that Jesus did on the Sabbath day, and that was against regulations. So here we go. Another time, Mark 3, 1 to 6, another time Jesus went into the synagogue, and a man with a shriveled hand was there. Some of them were looking for a reason to accuse Jesus. So that's the context. People just watching out, you know, what's he going to do? That's wrong. Some of them were looking for a reason to accuse Jesus, so they watched him closely to see if he would heal on the Sabbath. I mean, that's a remarkable sentiment to have towards someone. Not, goodness, miracles are amazing. I wonder if one will happen in our midst, but we'll watch to see if he does it on the Sabbath day. You know, miracles, sure, but, you know, is it on the Sabbath? Is it on the Sabbath? That's their concern. Jesus said to the man with the shriveled hand, "Stand up in front of everyone." Then Jesus asked them, "Which is lawful on the Sabbath, to do good or to do evil, to save life or to kill?" But they remained silent. He looked around at them in anger and, deeply distressed at their stubborn hearts, said to the man, "Stretch out your hand." He stretched it out, and his hand was completely restored. Then the Pharisees went out and began to plot with the Herodians how they might kill Jesus. So it wasn't just Jesus who was angry. They were very angry as well also. Well, what do you make of this particular account of an angry Jesus? And I guess like all biblical accounts, it has a context. It has a broader context. And for a while, Jesus, who had burst onto the scene as this teacher, this miracle performer, this man with a different kind of a message, has been hounded by religious leaders who are very, very threatened by what it is that he's saying and he's doing. And it starts when he heals a man who has leprosy. You find that account at the end of Mark chapter 1. And then he goes and he does the unacceptable. Mark chapter 2, he forgives and heals a man who's been paralyzed. And I don't know if you remember the particular account there in Mark chapter 2. It's the account of the paralyzed man. There's so many people there, they have to lower him down through the roof. And before Jesus heals him, he says to him, "Your sins are forgiven." And all the religious leaders come all their opposition kind of builds up inside them, because who can forgive sin but God alone? Now, let's face it, their theological objection was valid. Who can forgive sins but God alone? And who did Jesus think he was going to say to this paralyzed man, your sins are forgiven? I beg your pardon, that's God's prerogative. But that's the whole point. Jesus was in fact saying, I am God. And the Pharisees got that point. And they said, this has to be blasphemy. This man has to be stopped in some way. And so from that point out, they try to find fault with him. And they try to convince people, because on the one hand, they're trying to be, and I'm just trying to put it so that we can understand their case. From their point of view, they're trying to say, we're trying to preserve the crowd from being conned. You know, this man must, I mean, it's impossible. Only God can forgive sin. How could he be God? Therefore, obviously, he isn't who he says he is. These miracles are fraud in some way. We must act in a protective way towards others. And so they try to trip him up. And you find then in the next account that they go and they're watching him. They see, look at the people he's keeping company with. He eats with tax collectors and he eats with sinners, and probably that meant prostitutes. And he keeps company with all kinds of unacceptable people. And so they come back and they say, you know, listen, everyone, you know, you can't possibly believe in Jesus because he, just look at the disgusting company he keeps. How could this man be God? How could he be who he said he was? And then they go and they look a little deeper, and they see that, you know, whereas they fast regularly, and Pharisees usually fasted twice a week, and whereas the disciples of John the Baptist fasted regularly, Jesus and his disciples just seemed to eat and eat and eat and carried on as though they were just normal people. And, you know, how could this be if he was this special religious leader? And so they come and they say, by the way, you know, how can he be who he said he is? You know, he's just eating like everyone else is. You can't trust him at all. And then he goes on, he challenges, he actually eats and starts to pick some grain on the Sabbath day, and you're not allowed to do work like that in the Sabbath day, so they challenge him yet again. And then we come to this account, man with a shriveled hand, and it happens to be the Sabbath. Now, let's understand how Jewish thought went. You weren't supposed to do any work on the Sabbath day, and that was because it was a day to honor God. And if it came to the question of miracle performing, what were you allowed to do? Well, I mean, it's nice to think that people could philosophize, though, you know, it's so difficult to try to control miracles, like they're happening every second. But the Pharisees thought everything through. And their thinking basically went like this. Well, you know, if someone is in the process of dying, then obviously you must intervene. So if it's the Sabbath day and someone suddenly starts to choke, well, then that's right. You must pat them on the back, because otherwise they might choke to death, and their dying would be a terrible thing. It would be worse than breaking the Sabbath. You see, for them was always the which was the worst sin. So the worst sin would be to let someone die. It's still a sin to actually pat someone on the back and work on the Sabbath, but that's not as bad as letting someone die. So it's appropriate then to do a little sin to avoid this larger sin. So areas like that were fine. But here's a man with a shriveled hand, and he wants it healed, but why couldn't that happen on Sunday? Because let's remember the Sabbath was on a Saturday. So would the man be dead if he had to wait for another 24 hours? No. Therefore, could a miracle take place on the Sabbath like that, healing a man with a shriveled hand? No, because it wasn't urgent. It could wait. I mean, good gracious me, this man probably had his hand like this all his life. You know, what does another 24 hours actually matter? So in their eyes, it was perfectly clear that if Jesus heals this man, then it's just another sign that he's some kind of a fraud, that he doesn't really understand what faith's about, that he's up to no good. And Jesus looks at them, and he senses this context absolutely. He has this context. He has this, I mean, this poor man whose life has been held back for decade after decade. He has this man has the opportunity to be healed. And the God people of his day, because that's who the Pharisees were, the God representatives of the day, are saying, you know, don't heal him now. You know, mustn't do that because the Sabbath is so incredibly important. And Jesus just feels angry at that. And notice how intentionally he knows he's been set up here. And Jesus doesn't back away at all. Look at verse 3. Jesus said to the man with the shriveled hand, stand up in front of everyone. Stand up in front of everyone. He doesn't kind of go to the man and say, listen, mate, this is a very awkward circumstance. Everyone's gunning for me at the moment. But if you meet me down at the pub, you know, at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, I'll perform a miracle for you. You know, he could have done that. Could have avoided all the conflict. A man's hand could have been healed, and it would have just been ever so nice, and the Pharisees wouldn't have known what to do. But he doesn't do that. He actually says this is a fundamental injustice that we're facing here. And so come on, man, you come and you stand in front of everyone. Exhibit A, as it were. And then he addresses the elephant in the room, Sabbath day. And how does Jesus speak? Then Jesus asks them, and I think we need to get the tone in which he would have asked correct. Then Jesus asks them, and he doesn't say, so what's lawful on the Sabbath, to do good or evil, to save life or to kill? Nice, interesting theory. You know, what do you think, maybe? I suspect he's quite angry already. So what's lawful on the Sabbath, to do good or to do evil, to save life or to kill? Come on, you the religious people, you the God people. I'm going to do something good here. I know you're going to try and trap me up. I know you're going to try and criticize us, but come on, get your fundamentals here. What's wrong with you? What's wrong with you? What's wrong with you? Why can't you see that healing this man is so much more important than the Sabbath principle? See, this is an angry Jesus. I'm sure that's how he would have been speaking, and it's backed up because the text said that straight off them, he looked at them in anger. He looked at them in anger. And deeply distressed, their stubborn heart said to them, stretch out your hand. You see, he's angry because he poses that question, which is lawful on the Sabbath, to do good or to evil, to save life and to kill, but they remained silent. And you can almost sense it. They folded their arms. You can see the kind of sneer. Not interested, thank you. Not interested in this person. And Jesus' anger just wells up as they see this group's complete indifference to this man's circumstance. And if you go into the Greek and you unpack it a little bit more carefully, and I'm not going to do that because I don't want to become technical here. It's actually quite interesting though, because it says he became angry and deeply distressed at their stubborn hearts. And the implication, if you go in the tenses there, it's that the anger comes up briefly for a moment, it kind of bursts to the surface, and then it's replaced by an enduring emotion. And the enduring emotion is distress or sadness. He looks around, he's furious at the start, and then there's just this deep sense of, I'm just so sad that people are like this, that they actually get completely wrong. That you can be here playing this religious game, and you have absolutely no concern whatsoever for this man. And he heals him. And when we think about that anger of Jesus, I think that it's telling us that the anger comes up, but Jesus doesn't feed his anger. I don't know sometimes with children, we sometimes say that they're working themselves up. You know, they become angry and then they work themselves up by getting more and more angry and more and more angry and more and more angry. Psychologists apparently will tell you that anger usually is an emotion that lasts quite briefly, but you can reinforce it. You can make yourself angry. You can keep on going over the scenario again and again and again and again. Or you can transform it into another kind of an emotion. And we see Jesus actually transforming this emotion from this pure anger, which wells up at the hardness of people's hearts, and it's replaced by a much more constructive emotion, that of an enduring sadness that sees them actually having the courage to act in a different kind of a way. And I take from this first portrait of the anger of Jesus that with our own anger, we should think in terms of how we can change that so it becomes a redemptive emotion. Let me give you an example of what I'm thinking about. Many of you know that I come originally from South Africa, and back in the 1980s, Baptists in South Africa got together and built a home for street children called the Kayamandi Boys Home. And that home started, each person who helped was involved in helping to start that home for, and was a home for street children. They had their own story and their own reason for being involved in it. But I remember one man saying, you know, why he got so involved, and he was enormously involved in this home and making it possible for it to happen. He said that one night he and his wife had been coming home. They had been in the center of Cape Town. They had been doing whatever they had been doing. And as they were walking home, they were suddenly attacked by a group of street children. And they were robbed. And he said he just felt so angry when that took place. That he, you know, a well-built man, should be humiliated in this way by a group of children. Because they really were just children, 9, 10-year-olds. But they had knives, and there were several of them. And he was there on his own with his wife. And what could he do? And he said he just felt furious and humiliated, and he didn't know what to do with his anger. But he said that after a while, that anger settled. And he said, okay, so I was humiliated, and I felt afraid, and I felt embarrassed, and I felt all kinds of things, and I actually lost a fair amount of money. But he said that suddenly was replaced by this deep sense of sadness. What were 9 and 10-year-olds doing on the street? what was going wrong in the society that people and like this were out at that time of night, that they had no place to live. And he said that at that point he realized, he just had this growing conviction. He had heard that Baptists in Western Cape were starting this house for street children, and he just knew, God, this event is the reason why I've got to get involved in this, and I've got to make a difference here, and I've got to make it possible for this to happen. It started with anger, but it became quite redemptive. It was suddenly transformed into, actually, I'm going to do something about this. I'm going to make a difference. I'm going to be part of this home that can actually help kids like this, because this scenario should never actually happen. That's anger redeemed. Let's move on. Let's look at a second account of the anger of Jesus, a second angry Jesus. And this time, we looked at it, and it's his disciples that actually cause it. So we often think it's just the Pharisees that make Jesus angry. But if you go to Mark chapter 10, 13 and 14, we'll see a second angry Jesus. And let's look at this account here. And to be strictly accurate, it's an indignant Jesus more than an angry Jesus. But indignation and anger are sometimes quite closely related. Mark 10:13. People were bringing little children to Jesus for him to place his hands on them, but the disciples rebuked them. When Jesus saw this, he was indignant. He said to this, "Let the children come to me. Do not hinder them, for the kingdom of God belongs to such as these. Truly I tell you, anyone who will not receive the kingdom of God like a little child will never enter it." Now it's a passage that we know fairly well. And I guess we read it in the 21st century. And the status of children in our world is that they have almost become mini-gods in our age. You know, those of you who are older will remember that there was a time when children were to be seen and not heard. And pendulums swing back and forth in society, don't they? And the pendulum today has swung so that we really honor children and we're very protective of them, and we want to make sure they have the best life possible. It hasn't always been like that. In the ancient world, certainly in Jesus' time, children had absolutely no status whatsoever and were routinely disregarded. There were, first of all, just so many of them. It was not at all unusual for a family to have a dozen children. Some even had 20. Many of them, of course, would die before they reached the age of 5. In fact, half of children back in those days would die before they reached the age of 5. And if you walk down a street in Jesus' town, there just would have been children everywhere, getting in the way, tumbling over one another. They were just routinely overlooked. They had no status standing whatsoever. Again, put yourself in the disciples' position. Here Jesus is. He's gaining prominence. His ministry is important. He's very busy. And there are all these people who need to be healed and to be helped and everything else. And here are some parents are who are just neurotic. Like, I mean, they want Jesus to take time out to bless their children. Well, I beg your pardon. You know, they should have been presented at the temple in due course. There are little ceremonies that they were held in the society. They could have done it the right way. And they certainly didn't need any special extra blessing by Jesus, who really didn't have enough time as it was. And what they're really doing for Jesus is saying, "Jesus, we're going to serve as gatekeepers for you. We need to help you to protect your time because your time management skills are pretty poor. You never, ever reach your goal of having free time off, but we will help you in this instance." And so as these parents come and they want their children blessed by Jesus, they basically just say, "Go away. You know, who do you think you are? You really aren't important enough. Jesus got much more important things to do than that." And Jesus just, again, he flares up. And this indignation. Now, stop doing that. Stop sending these people away. Don't you know the kingdom of heaven is made up of children, and children have so much to teach us? And he said, "Well, what do we make of this indignant, angry Jesus?" I think that maybe here there's a real question or lesson to us potentially as churches and as a church even here, where we sometimes unwittingly act as gatekeepers of who can or cannot see Jesus. Because that's really what they were doing. You're a child, no, you can't see Jesus. You're this kind of a person, you're a Gentile, no, sorry, you can't see Jesus either. You're that kind of a person, no, you can't see Jesus. Oh yes, you look nice and respectable, okay, you can come and see Jesus. And that's what they were really doing. And sometimes in the way in which we structure our churches, we structure them in such a way that we just know that huge numbers of people will never feel welcome and they'll never feel comfortable. And we might not be saying to them, "Don't come," but we structured them in such a way that says, don't come, you'll never be comfortable. And I wonder if Jesus isn't a tad indignant with that and saying, why are you building up all these blocks and kind of structures that are church, that make it so hard for people to actually see me? Now, don't misunderstand me. I'm not trying to knock church at all. I'm definitely not trying to do that. But what I am saying is, is let's remember that part of the mission of Jesus is to find a way to make it possible for everyone to come. That our mission today needs to be to find a way to make it possible for everyone to come. And I'm not convinced that any one local church can do that, but we need to be open to wide varieties of what church is, that far more can actually come. Why not think about that one? Let's go into the third account, because time's moving on quite quickly. And probably the best known account of the anger of Jesus. Jesus at the temple. And you probably have known since if you went to Sunday school as a child, Palm Sunday, you would remember that Jesus is welcomed into the city of Jerusalem, and that's a great celebration, but no time for all. He's clearing out the temple, driving the money changers out, and you might have seen pictures of an angry Jesus with a whip, kind of saying, shoo, go, go, to all the money changers in the temple. It's worth looking at that instant, and I want us to look at it again just quickly now. So it comes in Mark's Gospel, you find in Mark chapter 11, and it's really important that you note the opening verse, Mark 11, verse 11. Jesus entered Jerusalem and went into the temple courts. He looked around at everything, but since it was already late, he went out to Bethany with the 12. Now, why am I wanting us to emphasize verse 11? Because sometimes we get the impression that Jesus goes into the temple and seeing all the money changing that happens in the temple, there's a boom and an explosion and he's just driving everyone out. No, actually, this passage makes it quite clear that's not quite how it happens. He very intentionally goes to the temple. He's just arrived in Jerusalem. He's in one of these pilgrimages feasts, which happens to take place at the Passover. And as he goes into the temple, he looks very carefully at everything that's taking place and he sums it up. And then he goes back the next day and he clears the temple. There is something very calculated, very intentional, very deliberate about what he's actually doing. It isn't just the sudden surge of anger. There's an underlying anger that this should be like this, but it's not an angry outburst as such. It's intentional action. And let's then read what does happen. So he looks verse 11 and then you pick up verses 15 to 19. On reaching Jerusalem, Jesus entered the temple courts and began driving out those who were buying and selling there. In other words, he made up his mind, he goes back, and he immediately starts to clear it. He overturned the tables of the money changers and the benches of those selling doves, and would not allow anyone to carry merchandise through the temple courts. And as he taught them, he said, "Is it not written, 'My house will be called a house of prayer for all nations,' but you have made it a den of robbers?" The chief priests and the teachers of the law heard this, and began looking for a way to kill him, for they feared him, because the whole crowd was amazed at his teaching. When evening came, Jesus and his disciples went out of the city. Okay, so what's happening here? Let's remember, this is Passover. So what's Passover? Well, in the Jewish year, there were three major pilgrimage feasts, and Passover was one of them. And if you were a good Jew, you were supposed to make the journey from wherever you were living to Jerusalem to worship at the temple during these three feasts. And of the three of them, Passover was probably the most popular, because though you were supposed to go three times, in reality, most people could only afford to make the journey once a year. So if you're a fairly committed Jew, once a year you go off to the temple, and you were supposed to make a sacrifice at the temple. Now that's where your first problem came in, because the sacrifice that you had to make at the temple needed to be kosher, needed to be pure, it needed to be unblemished. But if you're traveling a long way, how were you going to get a sacrifice? How are you going to make sure that your lamb or whatever it was that you're going to sacrifice wasn't actually damaged in some way? It was almost impossible to do. Don't worry. The temple has things under control for you. When you get there, you don't have to have bought your lamb from a long way. You can simply buy a lamb at the temple. Oh, yes, there's an interesting price set for it, especially at these pilgrimage feasts, because there's so many people here. And we do know that in fact, during the pilgrimage feasts, the population in Jerusalem would swell to something like 20 times their usual amount, which is why Jesus, in fact, has to go out of the city each day, because he almost certainly couldn't be accommodated within it. Most people just had to camp out on the hills surrounding Jerusalem. So, huge demand, and it would have been a market-driven economy. Great demand at lambs for the temple. Now, astonishing prices being charged to people. Second thing, though, when you buy the lamb, you've got to use money to do that. Ha-ha, here's a problem, because what money do you have? Well, you take out a coin, and whose head is on it? Well, it's Caesar's, isn't it? Because it's a Roman currency. Why? Because your country's been conquered by the Romans, so you're using that currency. I beg your pardon, this is money for the temple. The temple can't possibly have that contaminated money that comes from Gentiles. So you've got to change it into our money, which you don't have. Never mind, the temple will sort this out for you. It's just that it will charge you the most astonishing commission to do so. And so, you know, if you were a Jewish one of the religious leaders, and you asked, why are you doing this? You would say, you know, we do our best. You know, I don't understand where Jesus is coming from. He is so unfair. We really try to help the people. We go out of the way to make sure that there are these spotless lambs that are available for everyone to purchase. We make it possible for them to actually do it in the right currency. We're just so concerned for the purity of the people because we're very pious, devout people. And you might say, well, that sounds great. You know, you're wonderful Pharisees. Thank you for doing that. But of course, Jesus knew the rates that were being charged, and he knew how much money was being made, and he knew that the motive was more commercial than it was religious. And he's furious. And of course, he knows how difficult it is for ordinary people. Do you remember when his own parents had to go to the temple and make a sacrifice? In accordance with the law, it was supposed to be a sacrifice of a lamb, and what did they actually offer? Two doves. Why? Because they didn't have the money to afford a lamb. And the law specifically said, well, if you're poor and if you can't manage a lamb, then you can actually make the offering of just these doves or pigeons. Well, that was the position Jesus' parents had been in, and they'd probably told him the story. And as he looks at these crowds of pilgrims, and he knows that they've come out of deep devotion to God, and they're wanting to worship God, and he sees what's happening to them. He sees that some of them get there, and they discover that though they've made this huge journey, they just do not have enough money to pay. And others just have enough money to pay, but it's going to see them crippled for months and months to come. And he's furious that God's house should be used like that. And so he does the courageous thing. And he drives them out and he says, this is to be a place of prayer, not a place of commercial enterprise. And it is costly, costly, costly anger for him. Because as you look, the passage makes it very clear that after he's done this, the religious leaders determine that they will actually kill him. And so, verse 18, the chief priests and the teachers of the law heard this and began looking for a way to kill him. And they were successful just a few days later. So, you know, in terms of this, they've been plotting against Jesus for a long time. This is absolutely the last straw. Jesus stands up for justice and he's crucified a few days later. He's angry. It's an anger that leads to his death, but it is an anger on behalf of others. Let's look at the last of the accounts that I want us to look at of an angry Jesus. And I've got to say that this is the one that I personally find the most confusing. So I think I'm pretty accurate in the way that I've translated or interpreted the first three. I could be completely off with the way I'm going to translate this one or interpret this one. So don't view what I say about this necessarily being the last word. And you may have some ideas on your own. But I find this a very, very confusing outburst on Jesus' part. You find again Mark chapter 11 from verse 12. And it's probably significant that it's in the middle of the temple account. So it's between Jesus going to the temple, coming back and deciding that he's going to go back the next day to clear it. And as he goes back, there's this famous account where Jesus sees the fig tree that's bearing no fruit and he curses it, which is fine, except that it wasn't the season for bearing figs. So it sounds terribly unfair. Mark chapter 11, verse 12. The next day, as they were leaving Bethany, Jesus was hungry. So a very human Jesus, he's hungry. When's lunch? Seen in the distance a fig tree and leaf, he went to find out if it had any fruit. You can sense his optimism. Ah, you know, some wonderful figs, but to have them. When he reached it, he found nothing but leaves because it was not the season for figs. So that seems a pretty reasonable reason why you don't have figs because, you know, out of season. Then he said to the tree, may no one ever eat fruit from you again. And his disciples heard him say it. And he seems to be very effective because actually verse 20 and 21 says, in the morning as they went along, so the next day as they went along, they saw the fig tree withered from the roots. Peter remembered and said to him, Rabbi, look, the fig tree you cursed has withered. So what's that all about? I mean, don't you read that and think, ooh, that's a bit scary. You know, I mean, figs in the Middle East, they usually come to bloom, or you get your figs usually in June. This would have been March, April. What was Jesus thinking about? It wasn't the season for it. Except let's remember that this fig tree was filled with leaves. And being filled with leaves, it looked as though it was an early bloomer. And, you know, that does happen. And sometimes some trees bloom just a little bit earlier. And so Jesus clearly thought, well, there you go. You've got all the signs that you're going to be fruitful. So you're filled with leaves. I'm sure I'll find some figs there. I'm so pleased. You know, here's a tree that's actually bearing fruit quite early. And he goes there, but he finds that it's lots of promise, but there's nothing actually there. And I think that this passage is sandwiched in the Templar account, because Jesus is actually, or the writer of Mark's Gospel is actually making a commentary on what Jerusalem is like. It is the city where everyone speaks about Jerusalem, Jerusalem, my highest joy, incredible place. You've got to go there. It's the spiritual high of your life. You know, if you've never been in a pilgrimage journey, you must go there. Because one day when you go there, well, you'll see the temple and it's amazing. And you get there and it's this den of thieves just trying to rip you off of money. And it's even the trees there, like are pretense. They're filled with these leaves and there's nothing there. That's this city from start to finish, promising everything, producing nothing. And in this symbolic kind of a way, Jesus says, you've got to be who you say you are. Don't pretend. If you're filled with leaves, be fruitful. If you claim to be Jerusalem, be spiritual. Be who you say you are, because hypocrisy is not acceptable and will always be cursed. And beneath it, Jesus is actually saying to us and challenging us as a church, be fruitful, be fruitful. Don't promise so much. You know, we're the hope of the world, we're the light of the world. If we aren't actually a source of life, you know, if you say something, be it. If you're filled with leaves, have fruit as well. If you're not producing any leaves, that's fine, because then you're not making a false claim. But if you put those leaves out, then back them up with reality. That's my interpretation of that at any rate. Let me close before I open up for some questions by a quote, which I think is actually fairly significant. It's from Aristotle. So it's not a quote from a Christian writer, but I think that what he says is very, very profound. Aristotle once said, anyone can become angry. That is easy. But to be angry with the right person, to the right degree, at the right time, for the right purpose, and in the right way, that is not easy. Anyone can become angry, that is easy. But to be angry with the right person, to the right degree, at the right time, for the right purpose, and in the right way, that is not easy. And I think Aristotle is right. And I think my reading of Mark's Gospel leads me to believe that Jesus, as always, in his anger, was ahead of the pack, managed to do it. The right person, right degree, right time, right purpose, right way. Let me stop at that point and see what you'd like to ask or comments that you might like to make.
This is more a comment, I guess, but what you said about the Pharisees' concern that the people had the right animals and the right money and everything sounds a lot like our politicians' concern for people dying on boats coming to Australia. Just a strange hypocrisy.
I mean, I think that political spin is not unique to the 21st century at all. Not at all. And we need to do the Jesus thing and to dig deep always and say, what's really happening here? It means that we don't just accept superficial answers. You see, if you're superficial and you just listen to the Pharisees, we must charge a good price, because we've got to keep the temple, you know, in credit, and of course we've got to get the right currency. You know, it all sounds very respectable, but there was a deeper problem there, a much deeper problem.
Brian, can you just briefly just recap what the curse of the fig tree was about?
in two sentences.
I
think it's primarily about pretending to be fruitful when you aren't, pretending to be what you aren't. Now, I do want to give the writer, though, I think I'm right in the first three. I think this is obscure. I struggle with this one, so I'm not going to be dogmatic about it. But of the different interpretations that I've read, this is the one that convinces me the most, but it doesn't convince me 100%.
This might be part of an answer towards that, but I noticed that when Jesus is publicly expressing his anger, there is a prophetic element to it. It's not just a personal outburst. This is a message from God. You know, it's not that he's just angry because they don't get it in the synagogue. It's really important. You know, it's really important that they see this and they get it. You know, and so it's the same with the cleansing of the temple. You know, that he has decided. You know, he's gone out, and he's come back the next day with the intention to do this. He is making a very public statement, and it's very intentional. Mm. And the fig tree, then, if that is a prophetic act, an illustration, a metaphorical presentation of the malaise that that Jerusalem is sinking into. Mm. I think there's a certain consistency through all of these examples.
Yeah, absolutely agree with that.